Gonna start.
Sounds true.
And then stop again.
This committee of meeting of the Environment and Energy Committee will come back to order, and we have two bills on the agenda, and this being St. Patrick's Day, Senator Rosen wants to make sure we get out of here before 9:30 tonight. Senator Rosen sent file 237.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate file 237 is where we are going to be eliminating the requirement to obtain a certificate of need prior to constructing a natural gas plant generating electric that is exported outside the state. Just a little background on the certificate of need and the necessity for it. It actually has in the past protects ratepayers from an electric utility overbuilding to earn additional revenues at ratepayers' expenses. But Senate File 237 exempts the independent power purchaser, IPP, who invests and build in a project in Minnesota for export out of state or for regional wholesale electric market. If you remember last year, Mr. Chair and members, we did this for eliminating the certificate of need for wind. And so basically the bill, if you look at the bill, the Section 1, Subdivision A, and the exemptions, and on page 2, line 9, we're just basically saying that natural gas is exempt because basically the IPP needs to demonstrate a need because of out-of-state electric utility has agreed to purchase the electric power through a power purchase agreement. If the project fails, the IPP takes all the risk, and the Minnesota ratepayers bear no financial risk. The MISO's interconnection agreement with the IPP addresses the reliability concerns. And through a separate siting and routing permit, the environmental concerns are addressed. But sometimes with an unnecessary certificate of need, it can add about $220,000 in legal expenses and take another 6 to 18 months longer. So this bill would help Minnesota keep Minnesota as an exporter of energy, and with that giving our state better access to high-paying energy jobs, boosting local tax revenue, and taking advantage of Minnesota's unique situation in the regional transmission grid. Otherwise, we could see developers simply build projects in neighboring states with equal resources but less regulatory obstacles. Mr. Chair, I also have an amendment. That is that piece that deals with the certificate need for natural gas. But I also have the A2 amendment.
Senator Rosen moves the A2 amendment to put the bill in shape she like. Is there any discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. On the A2.
On the A2, Mr. Chair and members, this deals with repowering. This was actually just a separate piece of legislation that was introduced, and I just thought it would be good because it does deal with the certificate of need, saying that some of these older projects, wind project sites that date back to the late 90s, the early 2000s, they have older technology, and the wind turbines need to be basically, you know, new turbines, some new technology added to them. This would say that that these wind farms do not need to go through a certificate of need through the PUC, that they can basically get repowered not have the unnecessary regulations that would help reduce project costs and potentially allowing wind projects to sell their electricity to a utility at a lower rate, which would benefit the customer. So in provision one, the certificate, the con exemption for repowers that keep the same capacity. So potentially allows for fewer towers if they can reduce the system size from 50 towers to 30 and maintain the same system output. And then provision two, the con exemption for repowers that have greater nameplate capacity and only exempt if MISO certifies that there is a sufficient capacity on the transmission network to accommodate the increased power output. So there is two provisions in this bill, Mr. Chair and members. all dealing with a certificate of need, one for natural gas and one for repowering of our old existing wind sites. And with that, I have Mr. Ben Gerber from the Minnesota Chamber who would like to testify.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Gerber.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Ben Gerber. I represent the Chamber of Commerce. And I'd like to thank Senator Rosen and the committee for hearing this bill today. I know in the House and Senate, we've really been working on the need for reform in the energy system. We are still operating with a regulatory regime that was created in the early 1900s, and we would like to update it to reflect the changes in what we're seeing. Historically, we had vertically integrated utilities where they had their own distributions, transmission, and customers. That's been a great thing for Minnesota. We hope it continues. But what we've seen in the last 30 years or more is a proliferation of independent power producers. Those are companies that have gone into the power generation business, and they've competed directly with utilities and hopefully bringing lower costs to customers as a result. One of the things that we've noticed and has been an experience is that when these independent power producers go in to build a generation system, our laws haven't kept up with that change, whereas it was traditionally utilities doing this, and the laws were written to that. We now have independent power producers who don't have their own customers, they don't have a rate base, and the only people at risk in the development phase, at least, is the shareholders or the investors of the company. Why is this important? Last year, we worked on a very similar bill that exempted this for wind and solar. There was at least one example of a wind farm that incurred a delay. They were selling to an Illinois utility, and the Public Utilities Commission in Minnesota subpoenaed documents from the Illinois Commission. It delayed the proceeding, and they were forced to prove a need in Minnesota when really the need existed in another state. And these are benefits to the citizens of Minnesota. These facilities pay taxes. They, during the construction and maintenance phase, create jobs. And we've heard in this committee before, we've heard senators from both sides talk about, wouldn't it be great for Minnesota to be a net exporter of energy, even though we don't have these, we don't have traditional fossil fuel resources. We do have access to those, and we also have wind and solar. And so what this would do is reduce the cost for that development. And, for people that aren't very exciting like myself, I actually spend a lot of time looking at the e-docket system. And it was interesting to find, and I can cite to you the docket number 03-1884, and it was the Calpine's Calpine docket. Calpine was building a natural gas facility, I believe, in Mankato. Part of that excess was being sold to Xcel under a PPA. Part of that excess or part of the capacity they were going to sell onto the market. And they went through the rules and the statute, which are a little different today, but they basically had to spend time at the Public Utilities Commission and pay lawyers, I'm assuming, either outside counsel or inside, to go through all the rules and statutes and prove why this doesn't apply to an independent power producer. And how they don't have a customer system. They don't have promotional practices to increase the usage of their energy. They don't have captive customers. This is why I think this bill makes sense. And going forward to engage others and looking at reforming our energy system, this is a first step, hopefully, in a long discussion. And as far as the amendment, I think one of the things that I've done when working with developers, the U.S. Chamber and the State Chamber are really trying to emphasize a resource-agnostic approach that the lowest-cost energy should win out and that we should reduce regulatory burdens for all sources of generation. One of the things that we're starting to realize is Minnesota is one of the early adopters of wind energy technology. Those turbines tended to be less efficient and less reliable than today's technology. Just like anything else, 10 to 20 years can make a big difference. Those facilities were also built on some of Minnesota's best wind resources. And so we have less reliable and less efficient systems on the best resources. And so what this says is that there shouldn't be an independent power producer or utility. This applies to both, so everybody's on the same playing field in this bill. wouldn't have to go get a certificate of need to prove that there is need. There's already energy being produced on the system, and if they are going to increase the output, they would have to show that MISO has the capacity on the line, so they're not going to be creating issues with other transmission customers. And what this does is already disturbed land allows a much more efficient and cheaper process to repowering and putting new solar panels or wind turbines up. Interestingly enough, California did this. My understanding from talking to some developers and some of the developers that actually experienced this in California is California waited until the last minute, and they just said, well, we'll give all of the control over to the local units of government. Well, some of these local units of government didn't have the capacity to understand or have the resources to go through the permitting, so it ended up becoming very expensive, very cumbersome, and it didn't help anyone out. And so we'd like to, I think it's important that as Minnesotans that we try to stay ahead of the curve and not have to be reactive. This is a proactive measure. We're not aware of any independent power producer or regulated utility coming in or requesting a repower, but this opens up the door for that in a more efficient process. And why would a ratepayer advocate be sitting here asking for that? Well, I think the reason is that hopefully that will result in a cheaper process, which then gets passed on to the ratepayers or the consumers. And so I think that should be a benefit to all.
Thank you, Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the original bill, the not needing certificate of need for a natural gas plant, and I can't believe I'm the one saying this, but I thought our goal was less carbon being generated out of the state of Minnesota. How does this interact with 111D? And why, if natural gas is allowed, wouldn't coal be allowed?
Mr. Gerber or Senator Rosen, how does this react with 111D?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, thank you for the question. So 111D obviously is still up in the air. One of the things, and I think you've heard that a lot in this committee, about the final outcomes and what will be required. We know that utilities will likely, and we've heard testimony to that extent, that and some of the utilities that are in the room might be able to address that too, are going to have to run their natural gas facilities at a much higher capacity. So we also, it's likely that other states may also have to do the same or build new facilities. We know that there's going to be a lot more retirements. So this would actually allow, hopefully, Minnesota to be the place where these facilities are located. Just like we've located a lot of facilities in other states, we can make sure that when a facility is being evaluated, that we have a competitive advantage. I know Iowa, for example, allows petitions to be exempt from the certificate of need process. So we have surrounding states that already allow things like this.
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Gerber, then why wouldn't coal be allowed? We actually might have more of a competitive advantage for coal than natural gas because of our proximity to North Dakota. If we're going based on competitive advantage, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure, Mr. Gerber, why natural gas and not coal.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Benson, I think last year's legislation set it up for renewables with the wind and solar, and natural gas, I believe, is part of that mix. Coal, with 111D coming down the pipeline, does bring a different set of variables in, but basically to say that no certificate of need when we are exporting this resource out of the state, this renewable resource out of the state.
I also haven't heard any independent power producers looking at coal.
Yeah. Well, and Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, I mean, 111, there's 111D and 111B, and 111B is the new source emissions, which pretty much from the federal government prohibits any new coal. And that's not a comment on whether I agree or disagree with the rule. It's the reality of what the federal government has said. So I don't think, based on that somebody would do that.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But we've tried to, in this committee, whether I agree or not, make Minnesota a net exporter of energy. But if you're bringing in natural gas and burning it and turning it into electrons and sending it out. It's not, we're not really a net exporter, so I'm not sure how this fits. The repowering piece, I think that makes sense. I'm just not sure how this fits, and I don't know how hard I should fight. Maybe we should just build as many plants as we can and send all the energy out of the state. So somebody help me reconcile this with what's been going on.
We do have some other witnesses, some of whom are, I'm guessing, supporting, some of whom, I'm guessing, are opposing. So maybe we just continue with testimony. Are there any further questions from Mr. Gerber right now? If not, thank you very much. I have next Deb Bergen and Thor Underdahl. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Marty and members of the committee, thank you. Again, I am not Deb Bergen. She sends her apologies. She had a family emergency and was not able to travel this week. My name is Elizabeth Wafel, and I am testifying on behalf of Missouri River Energy Services. I am here to express concern over SF-237. Basically, by way of background, you know, if Missouri River or any other utility is building a new natural gas facility in the plant, we would have to go through the certificate of need process to determine if there was a need. You know, it would be looking at not just customer demand, but looking at forecasts for future demand, what has been achieved through the CIP, what CIP savings will likely be achieved in the future, and also importantly, the impact on the state achieving its statewide greenhouse gas reduction goals under 216H. Also, when power providers and I, like Missouri River or an IOU, they also have to file integrated resource plan. And similarly, there's a number of different things that get looked at, but also how the utility plans to meet these statewide greenhouse gas reduction goals, not only in terms of construction of new plants, but also in terms of the long-term contracts for power they're undertaking. What we think this proposal does is allow some generation to basically circumvent the entire process, which we believe could cause problems with both meeting 216H and with the Clean Power Plan. You know, even though we don't have the final rules out on the Clean Power Plan, what it looks like is that the state will be drafting an implementation plan. It may require even more significant greenhouse gas reductions on behalf of the utilities than the final EPA rule does. It's also likely that a situation could be created where all of the greenhouse gases attributed to power generation facilities are attributed to that state. And go into the greenhouse gas reduction target for the set by the EPA. So basically, what could happen is we have you're allowing a non-utility, a non-regulated entity to add greenhouse gases to the state total without having to go through the approval process. So then the question becomes, how does that affect the other utilities in the state in terms of how these regulations are going to play out? And so conceivably, we could be in a situation where the burden there falls to the ratepayers of the other utilities in the state to deal with those additional greenhouse gases. And there's also the question of how it impacts the reductions under 216H. There's a lot of questions that will be coming up under the greenhouse gas, Clean Power Plan, and we think that those need to be resolved. We're also concerned, like I said, about how this affects the 216H. And we think that, you know, we need to answer those questions first. With respect to the amendment on this bill, I don't think anyone doubts that the repowering issue is something that needs to be dealt with. We're just not certain yet how it should be dealt with, and it seems to be a conversation that we probably need to get more power, you know, players to the table. And I think the conversation probably needs to happen, but it might be something perhaps for the interim to look at. Again, I want to thank you, and if anyone, I stand ready for questions if anyone has any
questions. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe Ms. Wifel can answer this. If not, I definitely want our folks at Commerce to answer this question, because she's bringing up a very interesting point, Mr. Chair, is that, you know, how does changing one deck, you know, go out as far as ratepayers and other systems? And One thing I've really learned this last year is Minnesota has kind of a unique system, and you know, you try to fix something on a municipality or on the co-op, yet the IOUs, it affects something there, which affects a ratepayer here. It's just this dysfunctional kind of interchange that goes on without really talking about an end result, which is what the goal we're trying to achieve here. And I don't mean to get on in banter, but I really want to know, you know, when you do something without approval of the process, are you upsetting that golf cart? Are you upsetting that apple cart? Are you upsetting the system that we have in place? And why aren't we having a deeper conversation about how our system looks as a whole? And I'll give another example. You know, when you talk about cogeneration, you know, cogeneration might work for one aspect of it, but you know what? It doesn't work for one of the IOUs or two of the IOUs. It doesn't work for, might work for Minnesota Power, it might not work for Xcel. And I'd like to see, Mr. Chair, us and Ms. Weifel, thank you for bringing this forward, is have a deeper discussion about 216H. What about our SIP plan, RDFs, how this affects everybody for our end result? And thank you, Senator Benson, for reminding us. This is what we're trying to do in Minnesota. I like that approach because when you try to go for, you know, our less footprint, carbon footprint, we're going to do what we're doing. And even though you said might disagree with me on this, but the fact is you bring the point, this is what we're doing. Why isn't this an end goal? And why aren't we trying to do to achieve that? So I'd like to get the Commerce Department, I think Mr. Yes, he is over there, maybe toward the end to talk about how these changes affect everybody in the pool.
We will put him on the list of speakers there, 1, 2, 3, 4, including him then. So, other questions for Ms. Weifel? Go ahead, sir. Mr. Underdahl.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Thor Underdahl with Minnesota Power. I appreciate the opportunity to be here and speak on behalf of this bill. Again, appreciate Senator Rosen's bringing this bill forward. Minnesota Power has been actively engaged in trying to work on this regulatory reform issue on the E21 process and other initiatives. So we think this is a really important step, and being forward thinking is always a good thing. There is one provision of the bill that we do have concerns on, and that's removing the certificate of need for the natural gas facilities that would export their electricity. And our concerns are primarily based around the issues of 111D and the Clean Power Plan. As the plan, which is still in tentative status, currently exists, it would really be up to the state to decide if the carbon emissions for fossil fuel generations, new fossil fuel generation in that state, would be allocated to that state rate-based or mass-based emissions. Because of that, we want to make sure that we understand that rule before we move forward, and we don't do things in a way that wouldn't be prudent towards making sure that we're respective of our ratepayers and customers. Also, the final rule, the EPA could choose to reconcile those in another way, and again, those are just things that we don't currently know, and along with many other pieces of policy that we've suggested, we'd be prudent and thoughtful about. This is another one that we think would be best served to be discussed at a future time that seems a little bit more appropriate. So thank you for your time, and I'll answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? If not, Rick Evans and John Hottinger.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy, and some of my utility colleagues have already gotten up and expressed a few thoughts, so I'll try not to repeat them and be brief. The first thing I would say is that I understand Mr. Gerber's point about deregulation. That's a position that some chamber members have taken for a long time. Our problem with this bill is this is piecemeal deregulation. You deregulate it. He talked about the competitors that public utilities have in the independent power producers. And so what we're trying to do here, it seems, is deregulate our competitors while the public utilities still remain with one hand tied behind their back in that competition and go through all of the processes. Mr. Gerber mentioned the Calpine situation. Perfect example. We wanted to build a gas plant down at our Black Dog facility, converting that coal facility to a gas plant. Calpine wanted us to instead purchase the energy from their plant in Mankato. We went through a competitive acquisition process, and the PUC actually ended up ordering us to do both. But the point is that if you were going to give Calpine a deregulated status in that competition while we remain a regulated status, you've made an unlevel playing field, and I think that would operate to the detriment of our ratepayers and our shareholders rather than a benefit. The second thing that I would mention, and this is just in response to Senator Benson's question, which is a very good one about 111D, to reiterate what Mr. Underdahl said, and that is, as Mr. Gerber said, these rules are up in the air. We are about to have a state implementation plan put together over the next 2 years, and it is quite clear that the state implementation plan can take into account all of the greenhouse gas emissions from power plants in the state of Minnesota, not just the existing ones and not just the ones owned by the utility. And if we don't know, before we start encouraging people to build fossil fuel plants in Minnesota, if we don't know what the, and I mean know for certain, what the impact is going to be under 111D, we may find ourselves doing something unwise after we find out what the final rule is. So I would encourage the committee to think seriously about that. I will say, on the repowering of wind farms, we don't have any concern with that bill, with that portion of the bill, and would encourage the committee to support that portion of the bill. But as to the natural gas plants, we have some concerns.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Questions from the committee? John Huttinger, welcome to the committee. We'll take Bill Grant next, unless there are others who wanted to speak.
Mr. Chairman, my name is John Huttinger. I represent the Sierra Club of Minnesota. Now, I know irony does not show up well in the transcript, but here we are again with Minnesota Power, Xcel, and Missouri River. Expressing our concerns about some legislation. And we do have some concerns, but it's not a lengthy discussion. And I apologize to Senator Rosen because I did not have an opportunity to speak with her. And as my former neighboring colleague, I regret that. We have a couple of very briefly expressed concerns. Number one, granting an exemption without knowing who's going to benefit from it is bothersome to us. We think it's necessary to have sunshine, especially in such a reasonably narrowly drawn exemption as to what's behind this. We've had some discussions with representatives with more knowledge than I on energy. I've had some discussions with Mr. Gerber, and we haven't been able to understand that. Number two, we're not very supportive of encouraging fossil fuel plants. That's just a basic standard concern of Sierra Club, which believes that we should be using alternative fuels. And finally, I think this is really important, and both Senator Benson and Senator Hoffman have referred to it, we need to understand these things in a bigger context. Senator Hoffman, I've heard before talk about the necessity of a in-depth discussion, and that would be worthwhile. The Sierra Club, of course, supports alternative energy. Was more receptive to this concept when alternative energy was included as the goal. But in any case, we do not support the proposal, and I don't have a point of view on the second half that was added here. But think that we need to know more, certainly. We hopefully don't give an exemption that encourages fossil fuel production without knowing more. And one last thing. Calpine was something I was very much involved in. Unfortunately, not as a lawyer for any of the parties, but rather as a legislator operating for free. It was my legislation that I introduced 2 or 3 times dealing with Calpine. And I got to know about that, and I've learned about cogeneration. I know the complexities of the problems. And with Calpine, of course, I was supportive. It was in Mankato, just as I'm sure that Senator Rosen has not only a broad support but a generalized support for the bill she's putting forward. So I think it raises some good discussions, but in conjunction with most of the other testifiers, it's certainly at this point not ready to be included in a final bill from the Senate. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm certainly open to questions.
Thank you. Questions? And Mr. Grant, did you want to speak to something, or did you just answer questions from Senator Hoffman?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to take Senator Hoffman's questions.
You may respond to his question. He's part of your presentation.
Perhaps you could reiterate your questions, Senator.
Mr. Chair and Assistant Commissioner, thank you. one of the things that always comes up is, you know, how is this going to be spread out to ratepayers? And you hear that whether you're talking about a co-op, you know, where it makes one sense. Every 40 feet you have a house in St. Paul. Every 7 miles you got a house out in McLeod Cooperative. And so there's always going to be an issue of ratepayer. And for the comment to come up that really struck out for me is what is the impact to the ratepayers when it comes to, and this is what the Councilor Weitzel said about, you know, the approval process and regulations, and how does that go with the ratepayers, and how do you reconcile this with the EPA? So it was in the context of that discussion that I asked that question, and I was looking over at you, and you were shaking your head like, yeah, I have an answer. So,
well, if I gave that impression, I was probably incorrect. But Mr. Chairman and Senator Hoffman, going back to, I think, the original purpose of the Certificate of Need law, and that was to assure that ratepayers were not being asked to pay for unneeded facilities. I don't see this as a completely analogous situation. We're not asking ratepayers to pay for any of the costs associated with these facilities. Ratepayers in some other state will bear those costs where the power is being delivered. So in that sense, the Certificate of Need statute is not a good fit for independent power production projects. We crossed that Rubicon, I guess, last year, or was it the year before, when we exempted solar and wind projects for the same reason. And I would have to agree with Mr. Gerber, and I don't do that often, that
does he need a rim shot?
That you know, we do need to be somewhat fuel agnostic when it comes to making decisions like this. On the 111D front, I appreciate the point, but I would also suggest to you that I don't think that the Certificate of Need process is necessarily the place where we would have discussions about whether or not a new facility would likely impact the state's circumstances with respect to 111D or not. It's not the kind of thing that the commission, the PUC, would normally take up in the course of a Certificate of Need process. So while I also understand and appreciate those concerns, I don't think that that's a reason not to move forward with this provision. Sorry for the double negative.
It was, Mr. Chair, not to. No reason not to. So if I'm understanding what you're saying, that the certificate of need process is not necessarily a good point of conversation in this juncture, but that you shouldn't stop the process, what Senator Rosen is talking about, from keeping on going forward. Did I understand you right?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hoffman, that's correct. I mean, I do have a concern, generally speaking, about the trend toward lowering regulation without thinking about whether or not the regulation applies or makes sense, or whether we're asking the right questions in this instance. As I've said before, the Certificate of Need law isn't a particularly good fit for independent power production projects. That doesn't mean that there aren't a separate set of questions that we should be asking about IPP projects. It's just that I don't think the Certificate of Need process is well suited to it.
Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chair, that helps. It's still doesn't get to some of the larger, bigger questions that I think, you know, I think we should have a summit on energy. You know, for this conversation, where is this bill, Mr. Chair, going to once it goes through this, our committee? Is it getting laid over?
This is being considered for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay, so we got room. We got room to talk about this. So thank you very much, Commissioner.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Mr. Grant. Yes, I'm trying to reconcile. This is all of our electricity is handled through MISO. I presume that this plant would be putting electricity into that as well. It's a market where you buy and sell. So basically we'd be telling people who generate and transmit electricity in Minnesota, you have one set of regulatory hurdles, and then go ahead and compete. And then we'd be telling this entity, you have no regulatory hurdles, go ahead and compete. I'm not sure that that's sound policy, given that our electricity generation and transmission isn't merely confined to Minnesota borders.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Benson, I understand the point. The difference in my mind is that Minnesota ratepayers aren't being asked to pay for the capacity from the independent power production project, whereas if Xcel or another of our utilities were to propose a project in the state or from to accept a power purchase agreement from another state, we would be asking those questions about whether the project was needed or not to serve Minnesota load. And I would expect by the same token that the state or states that the power is being delivered to have their own process for determining whether or not that power is needed and whether their ratepayers should be paying for it or not. So I think there is some reciprocity in that sense, and that would be my response.
Mr. Grant, this is worded in such a way that if it's not sold to an entity providing electric service wholesale retail in Minnesota, you don't have a certificate of need. You put the plant in and later, hey, we want to sell it in Minnesota. What do you do?
Well, in that case, Mr. Chairman, the question of whether or not that contract is something that that company's ratepayers should be paying for is a Public Utilities Commission question. And they would at that point determine whether or not it would be reasonable for those ratepayers to pay.
And how about comments on the A2 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I've only just seen it. I don't have any comments on it at this time.
Is there further discussion on the bill or the amendment or anybody else who wished to testify on it? Not
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Well, I would just like to say that I do appreciate the hearing. I knew the original Senate File 237 was going to be a heavy lift. I do think it's a very good discussion, though, we are having. Obviously, something of this magnitude, there's many people at the table besides the utilities and the environmental groups, but there's also 111D is at the table, and we have to keep that in mind. But I do appreciate the sincere discussion about this. I am very much supportive of the repowering amendment. I think that's a, if you don't mind me saying, a no-brainer, because we have a lot of projects that are near their end of their 20-year PPA, and it's just sensible to look at them and basically do a remodeling project up on them. We'd get more wind energy and just a better use of these wonderful sites. So with that, Mr. Chair, I really do appreciate the hearing and this great discussion.
And Senator Rosen, before you leave, one more question about these, the two sections, the two paragraphs in the repowering one. The first one where it's not exceeding the nameplate capacity, I don't know enough about the size of the towers and are most the repowering ones under paragraph B, are those tending to be bigger blades, or can you not do that on the same size facility? How many of the ones that are getting rebuilt now are going to be paragraph A? How many are paragraph B? I'm just curious how big of a deal.
And those are very good questions, Mr. Chair. I will defer to Mr. Gerber, but to me, you already have towers already set up. They're more efficient turbines and blades. And, of course, you'll be dealing with setbacks and a lot of issues that do come with this repowering. But still, it just makes sense to get more out of those sites that are already used.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, thank you. So we were hoping to have a developer here to talk about it and also discuss their experience with California and how this would help. There's two ways that we've imagined that this could happen, or at least the discussion of what a developer would do, whether it's a utility or an IPP. You can actually use the existing structure and put a new nacelle on, which is the actual generator with the blades. And that would depend, obviously, on the engineering and the physics of the new nacelle. Or you could rebuild the the sites, and the reason why we think this makes sense too is that this is already, you know, quote unquote disturbed land, not actually disturbed, but there's already been building in the area and on the land, and so infrastructure. Sorry, and one of the things that we were hoping and why this makes sense too is there's already extensive amounts of concrete put in the ground to hold the turbine upright. So those are all things that hopefully would be reused. That would save customers, utilities, everybody money in the process. So I think there's two ways that it would likely do. You could do that. And also, because of the efficiencies in the turbines, it's likely that you would actually have less turbines or less infrastructure in the existing footprint. So it would actually probably be a benefit to the residents of the area. I know some people like the turbines, some people don't, but the same would be for, you know, solar is a much earlier technology, so I don't know too much about that, but I'm assuming in the next 20 years, we've heard that these will last 20 to 30 years. If that happens, I'm sure that the technology in 20 to 30 years will be, you know, multiple times better than what was put in the ground today, so hopefully that would lead to efficiencies for and cost savings for everyone.
Thank you. Yeah, I would love to hear from somebody who does these, if you can get from 1 meg to 1.5, or, I mean, I don't know how much it's the efficiency of the blade shape and how much it's the size and so on. But, maybe somebody, Mr. Coco, just real briefly, yeah, just curiosity.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Chris Kunkelin with Wind on the Wires. A lot of our members are the developers that are working on this, and we've been lucky enough to collaborate with Senator Rosen and the chamber on this. I think what we're trying to do with this is cover the two different options, you know, the same size as well as bigger system sizes. The idea is that for the nameplate capacity to stay the same, that you could reduce the number of towers within that wind farm. So if it's a 50-megawatt project that today has 51-megawatt towers, you could go to 25 2-megawatt towers and then, you know, use the remaining 25 towers for, you know, either get rid of those entirely or seek a new permit for a new wind farm using those same structures. That's the general idea for it. I think it, is that helpful?
I just was curious on one tower. Mm-hmm. Can you take a 1 megabyte? One megawatt turbine, and can you make it 1.25? I mean, what's the efficiency done in recent years?
Yeah,
1.5.
Mr. Chair, part of this is, you know, this is a proactive policy, and Minnesota has been a leader on wind energy, and we're going to be one of the first states that are, you know, really seriously looking at the issue of repowering. It is going to become an issue of physics and engineering, insofar as how much weight can one of those towers hold. It's going to be a bigger turbine up there in theory. It is going to be more efficient. The technology, the software inside of them are going to be better. So it's going to come down to what, you know, what makes the most sense from an engineering perspective. So it's going to vary. And again, we're trying to cover all of our bases here by having a provision for the same nameplate capacity as well as something to account for bigger projects.
I think, Mr. Chair, briefly, in the discussions that we had with some of the experts, it's my understanding that that members of MISO or transmission owners can't hoard capacity, meaning that they can't build extra and keep it for their own for later. And so if there is extra capacity, you're not really taking anything from anyone. It would already, so if you do upgrade the system size, it's because there is the ability that MISO has confirmed it. So you're not infringing on anyone else's property. And I'm assuming you'd have to pay for that, the upgrades with it as well.
Okay. It's preemption too. Thank you. Thank you very much. We'll turn to propane. We'll lay this bill over for possible inclusion.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members.
Senator Coonan, Senate File 925. And while he's coming up, I'll mention something the utilities probably all know, but for members of the committee, the tax committee, I believe on this Thursday morning at 8:30, is taking up a look at utility energy property taxes. I think the industry folks are very aware of it, but for committee members, Senator Scoy said any of our committee that wants to attend it are welcome to do so.
Either.
I know Senator Eaton will be there. She's on the committee, too. But if others are interested, that's 8:30 this Thursday. Sarah Coonan, welcome to the committee. Senate File 925, and it looks like you have an A1 amendment as well.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, yeah, I'd like to move the amendment.
Sarah Coonan moves the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'll try and do a run-through with the changes. This all just happened, so I'm still trying to get caught up myself. But what with the amendment now, there's definitions of propane, definitions of propane storage facilities, excluding propane from the definition of synthetic gas exempts a propane storage facility of 100,000 gallons or more from the requirement to prepare a mandatory environmental assessment worksheet and obtain a certificate of need from the Public Utilities Commission. And it increases from 2,000 to 5,000 the number of natural gas customers a public utility may serve without having its prices regulated by the PUC. And also the bill excludes a propane storage facility from the definition of large energy facility, thereby exempting the storage facility from the requirement to obtain a certificate of need from the PUC prior to construction. And expands the definition of energy improvements under the PACE statute, the Property Assessment Clean Energy, to include the installation of infrastructure and appliances necessary to allow natural gas and propane to be used as a heating fuel in a building that previously was not connected to natural gas or propane. And it deletes the language that allows for a sales tax exemption on the purchase of propane tanks. That's actually another bill that will be heard in taxes tomorrow morning. And it also deletes the language that transfers $300,000 from the solo thermal rebate account to the Commissioner of Commerce for use in energy conservation programs for low-income persons. That language is all deleted. And requires the Commissioner of Commerce to submit a report to the legislature by January 1st of 2016 and 17 addressing the operations of the propane purchase program, and appropriates $5 million both in fiscal year 16 and 17 from the general fund to the Commissioner of Commerce for propane pre-purchase program, and then the commissioner must reserve $5 million each year from the Federal Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program and transfer those amounts to the general fund as a reimbursement to that account. And so that's a quick run-through of the bill, Mr. Chairman. And if you're ready, we can take testimony or
sure,
whatever.
Sure, we can begin with testimony unless there are questions from the committee beforehand. Go ahead, Mr. Leiden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee, I'm Roger Leiter, Executive Director of the Minnesota Propane Association. I'd like to first of all state that the propane industry is in much better shape than it was 1 year ago. That is in due large part to all stakeholders in the industry, the propane suppliers, the propane transporters, propane marketers in the state of Minnesota, but most of all propane consumers within the state of Minnesota. It took a lot of effort to move people into a process of pre-buying propane, budgeting their propane sales, contracting for propane, and that helped the supply situation. What we're looking for out of this bill is to help that process by making sure that we clear up any language issues that we would have with synthetic fuel definition that impede the process of building more propane storage and infrastructure. We're thinking that and feeling that the industry is headed in the right direction. We've got a little more time than it's going to take to get us where we really want to be. But the energy industry is changing drastically, as we all know, with the advent of the oil fields that we have in North Dakota and other places. And our ability to tap those and store those and use those here in Minnesota are going to be critical to the supply of propane for the state and energy use for the state. And so we're encouraging you from the propane industry and the Propane Association to move forward on Senate File 925.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Leiter? Senator Rosen.
Thank you. Mr. Leiter, well, maybe perhaps I'll wait until Mr. Grant's okay. Here. Yeah.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chairman Marty, members of the committee, my name is Patrick Murray. I'm with Cooperative Network. Thank you for allowing me to testify on behalf of Senate File 925 today. Cooperative Network is a two-state trade association of cooperative businesses of various kinds in Minnesota and Wisconsin. Our broad membership includes a number of local Minnesota cooperatives in the propane business. And a little-known fact is Minnesota is the number one cooperative state and nation, or maybe it is a known fact. We'd like to thank Senator Coonan for introducing Senate File 925. We have been and intend to continue working with him on this legislation, as well as his other propane-related bills, in an effort to encourage and incentivize the increase of propane infrastructure and to assist in meeting propane demand. In addition to Senate File 925, Senator Coonan had mentioned that he is also the author of Senate File 289, which will be up in Senator Rest's Tax Reform Division Committee tomorrow. That bill provides sales tax exemptions for the purchase of propane tanks and other related equipment, including valves and regulators. On to this bill, Cooperative Network supports the technical fix to the definition of propane gas because it is neither a liquefied natural gas nor a synthetic gas. We believe Minnesota statute should be amended to clearly define so that a certificate of need requirement is no longer inadvertently applied to propane storage facilities. It should be also noted that Cooperative Network supported a letter of comment to the Public Utilities Commission last June asking that they provide relief that could assist in meeting propane demand. We testified in support of the variance request, which was unanimously approved by the PUC commissioners, and among their findings was that the PUC, they agreed urgent action was appropriate and that additional propane storage was needed. However, the variance was granted for only 1 year. Once this variance expires this summer, any new propane projects over 100,000 gallons will again require a certificate of need. The intent of language included in Senate File 925 is to make the required changes in the definitions. We also support using the state dollars for the pre-purchasing of propane. The intent would be for the federal LIHEAP dollars to pay the state back. Due to the timing of the federal funding from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, we believe these dollars could be used more wisely. As members know, crop drying demand and extreme cold weather contributed to the propane shortage in the fall of 2013 and the winter of 2013 and 2014. The stresses were compounded by the three-week shutdown of the Cochin pipeline in preparation for permanent reversal, which exacerbated the problem. Once the pipeline permanently ceased service in April 2014, approximately 40% of Minnesota's propane supply was no longer available. Cooperative Network has worked on behalf of our members and have been involved from the very beginning on short-term and long-term efforts. In addition, Cooperative Network members have invested significant capital to improve storage and distribution to minimize future supply volatility. Much has been done to address the situation, especially in the short term, including hours of service relief over the past few years, as well as providing financial assistance to those in need. And we are grateful to those all involved with that. But this is also a long-term situation. Cooperatives are working to assure that their customers will have a reliable source of propane into the future. Increasing storage for propane is necessary. The technical fix to the definition of propane provisions outlined today in Senate File 925 is a step in the right direction, as are the use of the state dollars for the pre-purchasing of propane. We'll continue to work with Senator Coonan and other members on this legislation moving forward. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Do either of you know how many propane storage facilities have been put up in the last year or two? And were any of those above the 100,000 level that required a certificate of need, just out of curiosity?
Mr. Chairman and committee, yes, there were facilities that were put up that definitely required a certificate of need last year that were over 100,000. One of them was a large rail facility that was nearly 1 million gallons. And outside of that, most of the people that put up storage facilities, and I would say probably 50% of the propane marketers increased their amount of storage last year. Most of them probably stayed under the 100,000-gallon mark, so they didn't have to do a certificate of need and go through the legal process of doing that. And so that it kind of impeded what they really wanted to do. They will probably come back this year and add some more. It would have been more efficient to do it all at one time. But, I would say most of the marketers in the state of Minnesota, out of our 180 that we have, added storage. I would guess that probably in the neighborhood of well over 100 facilities were put in last year.
And with the pre-purchasing program and for LIHEAP, the state tried that 1 year or something, and it was a bad year to try it?
Mr. Chairman and committee, yes. It seems like if you try it 1 year, we usually pick the wrong one. But if we do it 10 years in a row, you're going to be right 8 out of 10. And even on the bad years, you're going to miss by very, very little. The upside and gain for the state and for the propane consumers is very high. The downside is very low. The important part of all of that is to help us pre-purchase propane and to pre-buy and fill those propane tanks in the summertime. Most of our propane is delivered on an allocation system. Most suppliers allocate 2 gallons of winter gas for every gallon that we sell during the summer. And Minnesota has been a traditional 4 gallons in the winter, 1 gallon in the summer. So now we've got to move our supply system, our storage system, and our marketing system to better reflect the realities of the new propane supply system.
And then one specific question on that section, the appropriation section where we'd be taking the LIHEAP money to pay it back. It says propane may not be distributed to customers before October 1st each year. Why is, in other words, the seller has to keep it until October 1st, even though it's, I, the customer, prepay you before September, but you can't deliver it until after October. Is there a reason for that?
My understanding is that comes through rules that are inside of Department of Commerce and from the federal LIHEAP program, because they won't allow us to pay back funds from one fiscal year to the previous fiscal year. Won't allow that in the state. We realize that happens with propane customers with LIHEAP. They will have a past bill, and we will pay their back bill with new funds. But for some reason, they won't allow the states to do that. So that's okay.
Thank you. Further questions? Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps this question is for Mr. Grant or Mr. Leiter. But haven't we ever studied this before? I thought there was a study at one time about propane and capacity and what we need to do.
Senator Rosen, the administration had a number of things going on, and the LEC did a look at that last year.
Oh, that's what.
That's what you're thinking about.
And then, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Leiter, is the oil being transferred on the rails coming out of North Dakota, is that affecting the ability to distribute our propane?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosen.
It's affecting our grain, is what I'm saying.
It definitely is having an impact. As Mr. Murphy related, that we lost anywhere from 25 to 40% of our propane supply by the loss of the Cochin pipeline. That most of that is being made up for by rail. The key is that we need to be on a consistent basis with rail. Rail likes to make deliveries all the time, not just during the wintertime. And so that if once we start to use rail on a consistent basis, we will have a much better program. To be very frank, they worked wonderfully this winter. Of course, we didn't have the same winter we had a year ago, but they worked tremendously. They've done a great job. They've moved a lot of product into the state, and there's great opportunities to move inexpensive product out of North Dakota into Minnesota by rail, and we would like to do everything we can to exploit that and use that for the benefit of consumers.
Thank you. We have Jake Hamlin, and also I think I heard several committee questions for Mr. Grant as well, if he could come up with. So, anything else for these two? If not, thank you both.
Mr. Chairman, Hamlin and I apologize. Just want to let you know Jake is not here this afternoon. So
okay.
He wasn't able to make it.
Is there anybody else who wished to speak to the bill one way or another. And Mr. Grant, maybe you should go up there because I think there may be questions as well. Thank you. Mr. Grant, any comments on the bill or just be there for questions? Your choice.
Chairman, I'm here for questions. We have comments on the bill.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Grant, is using the PACE financing a good idea?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, I think we ought to be creating as many opportunities to use that financing approach as possible. I see this as just expanding that list of opportunities.
Okay, thank you. I couldn't decide. I was going both ways on it. You helped me.
Further questions? Anyone have? Anybody else who had anything they wanted to add to the bill or speak to the bill? If not, we're going to lay this over for possible inclusion. I think parts of this would likely go in the omnibus bill, and parts of it would have to go separately, like the I think the tax provisions are going separately, but the propane pre-purchase of propane would be a separate item, I think. So, and we're taking the prepaid propane bill up on Thursday. I'm sure. Is there any further discussion? If not, we'll lay this one over for possible inclusion on Thursday as well. And if there are no further,
Mr. Chair,
Senator Rosen.
Yes, just can you give us a brief outline on Thursday, how that's going to work, what's happening, what's coming up?
Yes, except what's up to you? I don't remember. I haven't seen the schedule for Thursday. Can you speak to it, Ms. Jacobs?
Sure. We are taking up the bill on
omnibus.
Yep,
bill,
on the omnibus. The delete all will be available tomorrow, and then
you had other bills though, didn't we? We had a couple other bills, I think, for I don't remember what they were. Have they been posted yet? Or?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yep. Okay. The bills, we'll be taking up a number of bills. It'll be the last. The energy bill will be the last one on the agenda. And there will be opportunities for amendment. I imagine the energy bill will be at the later meeting. I don't think we'll get to it.
The afternoon, the second afternoon meeting.
Yep. Okay. But
the earlier meeting will be other bills, and if we roll out the draft omnibus bill tomorrow, then people can know what amendments to consider for it.
And it's your intention to move it out?
You move it out on Thursday if we can, yes. Because that would, I don't know if it has to meet first deadline. We've got this issue with the House. Everything's met deadline in the House. So, I mean, anything in a committee that has a policy and budget in the House, they're saying is meeting, has met deadline, even if it hasn't been heard, is the way I'm understanding it. And I'm not quite sure how.
How does that work?
Senate is apparently being very flexible with the House and deadline. So I don't know if Senator Dibble has that same thing, any bills in your committee, because it's policy and budget.
That's not how we're construing it, Mr. Chair. We're familiar with this phenomenon. What I understand is it's been heard and laid on the table. It's considered to have met deadline. I hadn't heard this other thing.
Well, I'm just hearing different interpretations from different House members.
All right.
And people who are tracking bills in both houses are saying different things. But I'm assuming we are planning to pass this out for first deadline. Is there further discussion? If not, we will adjourn until Thursday at noon.